Hello, my name is Dr. Vanessa Kimball, and I am a baker. But I'm also someone who has studied and researched the impact of bread on our health for many years. I run the Sourdough School in Northamptonshire, and my specialism is bread and the gut microbiome and the impact on our mental health. But I'm also trained as a nutrigenetic practitioner, meaning I look at the way that bread impacts people according to their genetics. It helps me to personalise bread. And in this podcast, I'm going to be chatting to someone who I hope you are going to find as interesting as I did. What I'd love is for you to listen and think about the bread that you bake, eat, and share with your family. Because bread is a staple, it's our most basic food, and I believe it is the foundation to good health.
Arielle Johnson, I'm head of research at MAD and resident scientist at Restaurant Noma.
Arielle, can you explain what MAD means?
Oh, well, so MAD is a funny pun if you speak Danish, because MAD is the Danish word for food, and we are a non-profit that works on food. If you don't speak Danish, it doesn't make a lot of sense, but now you speak at least one word.
Can you tell me the story of how you ended up working here? Because we're sitting on the... Let me just put you in the picture. We're sitting on top of a... this is almost like a container, a shipping container that has a roof garden at the back of Noma, and we're overlooking the canal and sort of central Copenhagen, and looking across at these boats, and the chef's kind of running around downstairs, and there's dozens and dozens of bicycles, and I'm sitting here with Arielle. We've got our feet kind of on the roof garden, and we're kind of hanging here. It's a fantastic spot to do an interview. How did you end up here?
I wonder that sometimes myself. So I'm a scientist and trained as a scientist, and have been working on food research and in collaboration with chefs and restaurants for almost 10 years now. In the course of doing that, I was in grad school, working in a wine flavor chemistry lab, studying flavor chemistry for my PhD, and I'd heard about what Renee, my boss now, Renee Redzepi, was doing with making test kitchens and starting labs and, like, really using a lot of, like, different and interesting resources at his disposal that, like, a cook necessarily, like, wouldn't always use. He had this project called the Nordic Food Lab, and, you know, I read up about what they were doing, read their blog, and I was like, wow, that's exactly what I want to do. So I figured out a, like, random connection through a professor that had once worked with one of my professors that had once worked on a project with Noma, and got an introduction, and then showed up here one summer and to work on studying some flavor and fermentation projects, and got along really well with Renee, got along really well with Lars, who was in charge of Nordic Food Lab at the time, and then a few years later, having collaborated with them for a while, I graduated, and then they hired me. So I came over here in 2014, and building this lab was the first thing that we did after I got here.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Boston, Massachusetts. I went to Brookline High School and lived there till I was 18, and then moved to New York for college.
What set you on fire? Where did the inspiration from the kind of chemist? Because it's not... it's a very male-orientated industry, really. And you're... you're a breath of fresh air because you're a female and there's a bit of... I love it. It's, you know...
Thank you. I mean, I've always been, like, really, really into science, ever since I was a little kid, really into food, cooking food, reading about food, when I was very small.
Who inspired you?
My grandmother cooked a lot and, like, collected a lot of books on, like, cookbooks and food books from around the world. And when I was little, as soon as I would get to her house, I would start, like, reading books, and no one could. So, Ryu, do you mind getting me a plate? Thank you. Do you want to do that again?
Karen, tell me about your grandma.
Okay, so, yeah, my grandmother had this, like, vast collection of food books, and, when I was little... As soon as we'd get to her house, I'd start, like, pulling books off the shelf and reading them, and, like, no one could distract my attention for, like, hours and hours. But, like, I've always been encouraged to, like, develop the kind of creative side and the more, like, analytical and scientific side of my work and my ideas. Like, my dad is a conceptual artist, but was always, like, doing science experiments with me and, you know, encouraging me to, like, read widely on the side. And for a while, when I was a teenager, I was, like, fairly certain I was going to be a fashion designer when I grew up. But you know, I was good at chemistry, like, good at writing, so kept doing that. And then eventually in college found a way to, like, bring food into it. I mean, this was around the time that, like... Harold McGee's book on food and cooking, the second edition of that was released when I was in high school, and Ferran Adria and Elboui was getting a lot of attention, so
Ferran didn't talk mm-hmm. much to me about fermenting. I asked him a lot, and he was very light on his mm-hmm. I kind of talked to him quite at depth. I was quite surprised, actually. In fact I was expecting to find what I found here with Ferran about 3 years ago, and this was what I was expecting.
Well, I mean, I think when you look at restaurants like Elboui and you know, which closed about 5 years ago, and others sort of that came into prominence around that time, there's a lot, like a huge amount that they did with bringing, like, research into the cooking process and like, looking at different fields of scientific study to do what they wanted. You know, at that time, they were, like, working a lot more with, like, polymers and physical chemistry and stuff like that. So with the food and the approach here, it can, like, seem superficially a lot less scientific, let's say. But I think, and it's perhaps less conceptual, but, you know, we're bringing in, like, many more fields of inquiry. So, like, stealing ideas from, like, botany and history and ethnobotany and microbiology and, you know, if Elboui made it possible for us and for chefs to begin thinking like scientists, I think what we're trying to do here is really, like, broaden the net of ideas that we're stealing from.
You have a unique understanding of the science meets the flavor of fermentation.
Yeah. yeah, I mean, my doctorate is in flavor chemistry, so I really specialize in understanding the molecular basis for flavors and then connecting that to...
Sorry, carry on.
Sorry.
Shut up!
What's
shut up in Danish?
I am not sure. and then connecting that to chemical and biological processes.
So one of the programs I'm doing at the moment is the sourdough program. Mm. It's very specific, and one of the areas that I've been trying to get my head around through my work and through my own work and through the research and what have you is how... the esters are produced mm-hmm. in the sourdough starter and how that translates into the loaf of bread. Is that, can you explain what esters are, how they come about, what the science is behind that, and how that actually ends up in our mouth with us going, yum, that's so good?
Yes.
Sorry, can I just hug you?
Okay. Well, I mean, I can explain. I can explain the basics, at least. Okay, so esters are a class of chemical compound. They're generally a lot of volatile esters, so ones that are gaseous and we can smell, related to fermentation. Esters are also found in fruits and other things. They tend to smell fruity. And in microbial metabolism, so the flavors and growth associated with microbes like yeast or bacteria, esters are formed as a byproduct of the main fermentation process, so converting sugars into alcohol or lactic acid. And basically esters are the chemical joining of an organic alcohol and an organic acid. So one very common class of esters is the ethyl esters. The alcohol in that case is ethyl alcohol, the alcohol that we drink to get intoxicated, the kind of main metabolite of yeast, of Saccharomyces cerevisiae. And there are a lot of kind of fatty acids hanging around in different fermentation mixtures like sourdough, so the yeast cell will join together ethyl alcohol with, for example, decanoic acid, and then you get ethyl decanoate, which smells pretty much like apples. Or ethyl butyrate, which is a bit more like pineapple-y, kind of. So you have this like pool of different sizes and shapes of esters, and they're produced as a part of the fermentation process.
Which is the banana one?
That's isoamyl acetate. So you can get banana flavors in bread fermentations, also in Hefeweizen beers is quite common. That is from the joining of acetic acid, second smallest organic acid, and isoamyl alcohol, which is a common sort of, you'd see it in whiskey as like a fusel alcohol. It's a sort of secondary metabolite of the yeast fermentation. The yeast cell joins together isoamyl alcohol with acetic acid, and you get isoamyl acetate, which smells like ripe bananas.
Oh yeah, what's the conditions to do that? Because, I mean, you have to kind of leave them for a while, but they have a shelf life. They have, maybe 3 or 4 day shelf life where they smell good, and then this kind of butyric acid kind of takes over?
Yeah, I mean...
What's happening in the jar? If I put my sourdough on the side,
uh-huh.
you start off just smelling out kind of like the weeds a little bit, kind of like a little bit, and then it kind of moves over. I mean, I do this on a regular basis, so I kind of... It moves from... What would you go from and to?
In that case, I would have to look up a couple of things to give you a very firm answer. What I would hypothesize is happening is that the longer you leave a sourdough starter, the more like byproduct alcohol you have as a result of the yeast growth. That allows acetic bacteria to grow in your sourdough starter, so your dough will get progressively more acetic sour rather than lactic sour, the more air and the more time you give it. For butyric flavors, that might actually be a process of like lipolysis, so like fatty things in the grain of the wheat.
It ends up smelling if you leave it on the side.
Yeah, like blue cheese.
Like stinky feet.
Yeah, I mean, so the classic like blue cheese vomit aroma comes from butyric acid. It's both. You can also get like quite a bit of pungency from hexanoic acid, which is just like a slightly larger organic acid.
And that we're getting out at the same time.
Yeah, I mean, like, anytime you have a process of lipolysis, you'll be breaking down fatty things into small fatty acids that you can smell. And not all of them have nice smells.
Now, just that's interesting because I've been working on the butyric acid in terms of health-giving properties.
Hmm.
The hectolysis, did you say? What, the other one?
Hexanoic acid?
Hexanoic, sorry.
Yeah.
Does that have any, do you know any...
I don't know, actually.
I'm just wondering if that supports the human gut microbiome.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if there were some bioactive effects, okay. But I don't know of any off the top of my head.
No, that's interesting. So... Sorry. I got pneumonia and I had this.
Oh no!
Yeah, we're straight back from Tartine and I got up on the plane on the way home.
I'm sorry.
So, you know, it was really shitty, frankly. And I have this little tiny dry cough left over. It's actually been pretty quick to get over pneumonia, but my doctor said, go home, get into bed, or I'm putting you in the hospital. I was like,
gotta take it easy.
Yeah. So, and then just to top it off, I then tore my ankle ligaments and fractured my ankle.
Oh my god!
Yeah, it was black until I was on crutches until about 4 or 5 days ago.
Wow.
Just.
Yeah, you should take it easy.
So. So, your job here, Ariel, mm-hmm. with these flavours and these bits and pieces that you're doing, and you're talking about sourdough and fermentation. What happens? The guys come to you and go, you know what? This is a great flavour, but I want it to taste a bit more like this, and you have to work that out.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I would say we're less guided by trying to hit a particular target, and more by trying to figure out the best ways to bring out the most amazing flavour from something. Which is, like, a little bit different, actually.
So do you kind of isolate flavors? Is that one of the things that you do?
Well, we don't go like down to like chromatographic isolation, but we do, you know, we have different techniques extracting with oil, with vinegar, with alcohol, doing various kind of water-based distillations where we do like concentrate and isolate flavors from ingredients.
So going back to the sourdough, your flavours that you're getting from your sourdough, I'm talking about really lactic acid bacteria,
mm-hmm.
you get quite a different flavour between your lactic acid and your acetic acid.
Oh, yeah.
Can you explain it to somebody on the radio?
Oh, okay.
What can you describe? I mean, there's two things going on
yes.
in a pot. Can you
explain? So lactic acid bacteria and acetic acid bacteria... are both bacteria that are named after the primary acids that they produce. Lactic acid in the case of lactic acid bacteria, and acetic acid in the case of acetic acid bacteria. Acetic acid you may be more commonly familiar with from vinegar. It's the acid responsible for that.
In sourdough, is that actually from the bacteria, or is the acetic acid produced from...
You can get acetic acid as a byproduct of yeast fermentation, including, and especially, like, wild yeasts, Brettanomyces and things like that. But generally, anywhere you have alcohol and oxygen, you also have acetic acid, because acetic acid bacteria are very excited to grow on alcohol. probably like the two big differences is that lactic acid is non-volatile, so it just tastes acidic but doesn't itself have really a smell. And acetic acid is volatile and has a quite pungent aroma. So acetic fermentations have this pungency that lactic fermentations tend not to. And the kind of aromas associated with lactic acid bacteria are more like buttery and creamy and sometimes fruity, less pungent. Sometimes you get like protein breakdown, so you get kind of cheesy smells, but they're pretty different.
So that protein breakdown, that cheesy smell, is from those fatty acids you talk about, but it's also from the
you can get different cheesy smells from different places.
Do you stick your nose in something and go, ah, that's the...
Oh, yeah, all the time. I mean, like, I'll stick my nose in like a soy sauce fermentation that we're doing, and we'll smell all types of furanones and other, well, you, the listener, would also smell those furanones, but I know that they're called furanones because I read too many chemistry papers, but that was a product of the Maillard reaction, and I mean, we're all smelling the same thing, but
I love to just watch you sniff something right now. So if you're smelling stuff, you're going, explain what furanones are.
Oh, well, furanones, they basically smell sort of bready and caramelly. They're a class of molecules that you generally get either from caramelizing sugar or reacting sugar and amino acids together. They're the kind of like classic byproduct of the Maillard reaction, which is what goes on anytime you brown anything.
All right, tell me this, okay? Because I don't want to let you go right now. I know you've got to go somewhere, but I'm just going to tie you to the chair and just carry on talking to you. Okay, so tell me this. Why is it that we humans find bread, and in particular sourdough, so utterly irresistible? Hmm. What is that? What's going on with that?
Well, I mean, bear in mind that we often think about smell, especially like in an academic discourse, as like a not very important sense. But the machinery that we use to smell are olfactory receptors. The genes that code for those make up the largest family of genes in our genome and comprise about 2% of our genetic information, which is the same magnitude of genomic information that separates humans from chimpanzees. So over millions and millions of years, we've expended a lot of evolutionary energy, I suppose, so that we are able to smell like a lot of different things and smell the differences between those different things. So I would say the reason probably that we like sourdough so much, especially compared to more industrial bread, is because there's so many more microbial metabolic processes going on. Those produce so many more volatiles overall and more types of volatiles. And it's just in our nature to take pleasure from these more complex flavors.
Do you think I'm going now back to the work that I've been reading and doing with Tim Spector. Mm. Do you think that smell is, I mean, this is an opinion, really, Ariel. Do you think that's telling us that food is just really damn good for us? Do you think that's what it's saying?
That is an excellent hypothesis. I would say you would, that is definitely, on the money as far as we know, but we need to do so much more research on these things, and we're not frankly doing enough research now based on flavor and maximizing flavor and its relationship to like ecology and our health.
I suspect that our instincts have been honed for us to, I think there's a lot of interrelationships between our senses and our health. And I think that's an area that, yeah, I think, and it's one of my suspicions with sourdough.
Yeah. I mean, and I think also if there were more scientists, whether they're microbiologists or like agronomists or food scientists that are actually talking to chefs and bakers, they would know this and we would be looking at it more. But sadly, it's still a rarity. It happens, but it's just not systematic, and it should be.
it's following the money, isn't it? The research.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's a difficult one because the most at the moment, the most sourdough really is the small artisan bakers.
Mm.
And that's really where Chad's kind of coming in with his work.
Right, yeah, and I think that's super amazing what Chad is doing.
So he's moving it into what I call everyman loaf.
Yeah.
So that sourdough is going to become mainstream.
Right, I mean, like, why shouldn't everybody have a loaf of tartine bread?
Exactly, it's probably one of the most unique social things. I'm really excited.
Waiting in line at Tartine.
I mean, the queue is like that long.
No, I know.
I've done that. So I don't see why we shouldn't get rid of like crappy white bread. Everyone should be eating it.
Totally.
Ariel, I spotted this on the side yesterday and I was looking at it. And you know, it's someone who's got insatiable curiosity. And I love to tell stories and have a chat. I picked this up really in a moment earlier, and I read a lot, and I'll be truthful, I'm dyslexic and I'm a baker, and sometimes I struggle with the science, I find it hard. I picked this up and I haven't been able to put it down. It's the most beautifully written piece of literature on fermentation I have ever picked up and read. Well, I just
thank you.
I'm at a risk of an American phrase, I'm blown away by it. How long did this take you to write?
That took me and Lars a little over a year to write.
It's called A Field Guide to Fermentation by Ariel Johnson and Lars Williams. It's a beautiful size, and I think it's the language you use. It's so comprehensive. It's so understandable. You wrote this for chefs, right?
So yeah. So it's a handbook that we wrote for chefs at Noma to understand and be able to use the fermentations that we do at the restaurant. We wrote it. I mean, we get chefs from all over the world who may or may not speak that much English, who have extremely varied levels of education. Some went to college, some were high school dropouts. So we wanted really to give people something where if they wanted to sit down and read for 3 hours, they could get something out of it. If they needed to figure out a recipe and understand how it works, they could read for 5 minutes and get that information right away.
I think you've deconstructed one of the most complex processes, science process, and turned it into understandable language. And that is an incredible thing, because I obviously teach it.
Mm.
And I'm learning, I've learned things here for the last sort of 24 hours. I have kind of put jigsaw pieces into place, sort of like I've had missing pieces.
Yeah.
And with David, that happened. And I pick this up and I'm just... excuse my language, because it's fucking amazing. Sorry.
Thank you so much.
Just sorry.
No, it's like that's what we wanted it to be able to do, to explain things well.
But I know how hard it is to translate it down to that level. Yeah. It's so complicated.
But, you know, like, I think that should be one of the responsibilities of a scientist, is to explain their work to people. So... I'm glad it worked.
That's a very interesting word that you've used there, Ariel. You've used the word responsibility. It's that sense of responsibility that I'm detecting here at Noma. It's almost like there's a sense of responsibility that's come throughout, and every single person I've spoken to here has got a sense of responsibility, and whoever's running this joint is empowering people. That's one of the most magical things I've ever come across here.
Hmm.
The whole team, everything.
Well, I think there's this sense of that, you know, for whatever reason, we have a lot of attention on us, and, you know, with that attention can come quite a bit of privilege. You know, not that many restaurants can have an entire lab out the back. It's a like crazy expense for a restaurant. So I think we all feel like, since we've had this good fortune and people paying attention to what we say, that we have to do something good with it.
If you enjoyed listening to that podcast as much as I enjoyed chatting with my guests, then you might like to find out a little bit more about what I do. Well, I teach courses both online and in person at thesourdoughschool.com. I also write regularly for sourdough.co.uk, and I have a couple of Instagram accounts that you might like to follow: Sourdough School, Sourdough Club. Oh, and I have a personal one, Vanessa Kimball. I really do love to hear people's thoughts and feedback about, well, the books I write, the podcast, the features, or if you have any questions, don't hesitate to get in touch. Thank you for listening.